This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about what's happening in the Gaza Strip. Joining us will be Muna Kubti from the Free Palestine Alliance.
It's been in the papers recently because Israel cut off all oil to the Gaza Strip. 1.5 million people, possibly one of the biggest prisons in the world.
We'll talk with author Peter Linebaugh about his new book, Magna Carta Manifesto.
If you think the Magna Carta was only about political rights, you're wrong. It's also about economic rights, the right of every human being to share the resources of the world, his or her country, his or her village.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Today, we want to give you some updates on some of the latest news that concerns liberty in this country. And again, we're glad to have back, at least on the phone, Dahlia Hashad, our missing fourth host. But this is her second week in a row. It's a good record, Dahlia. Welcome back.
Hi, it's great to be back, especially from a place of warmth. Yes.
Now, we do want a 10-second update on the baby. So, baby's name again, and how age, and how the baby's doing.
Yeah, baby Iman is great. She's in her fourth month, and, you know, as everybody with babies knows, growing every day and changing.
Dahlia, we wanted to get your thoughts. I know that you've been following this very closely. Jose Padilla got 17 years as a sentence.
Yep.
What was your reaction to that?
Well, we've been following this story for a long time on Law and Disorder, and folks can go to lawanddisorder.org, go to the search engine, and listen to the past stories covered with the lawyers for Jose Padilla. He was just sentenced to 17 years and 4 months in prison. He's 37 years old, so that means he's going to be, what, 54 or 55 when he gets out. As people will remember, he was first arrested in Chicago's O'Hare Airport. When he was transferred to military custody as an enemy combatant, it was summer of 2002. And I remember it very clearly because, and a lot of people remember it, that was when Christine Rowley was the FBI whistleblower. She was testifying in front of Congress. They'd had Jose Padilla in custody for quite some time, and all of a sudden, Ashcroft had a huge press conference. He was out of the country at the time. I think he was in the Soviet Union or something, to announce that they had this guy who was a dirty bomber. He was a highly trained al-Qaeda operative. He was going to detonate a radioactive bomb, a dirty bomb, in a major U.S. city. That they had him in custody, and when really he'd been in custody for many months. He was transferred then into military custody, and he became an enemy combatant, and we all know what that means. That means he doesn't get the protections of the criminal justice system.
And what was so horrific was that it showed the government's use of that category, enemy combatant, against an American citizen.
I mean, they'd been saying, we need this enemy combatant status, or this perversion of the enemy combatant status, to capture people who are on the battlefield in the midst of war and to really protect Americans. And this was a guy who was taken on U.S. soil, a U.S. citizen, spent 43 months, 3.5 years, in U.S. military custody as an enemy combatant.
Right. There's no right to habeas corpus if they denominate you as an enemy combatant.
Well, first they denied him a lawyer, any access to anybody.
Yeah. Yep.
They, of course, treated him horrendously, as I'm sure.
He was denied a lawyer for 21 months. I mean, imagine, this guy went through long periods of solitary confinement and sensory deprivation. So imagine being held in a small cell with blacked-out windows, no light at all, no clock, no calendar, no contact with the outside world, and denied a lawyer for 21 months.
Now, the Bush administration obviously played a shameful role, but I would say that the courts also played a shameful role because eventually he did get a lawyer. He got his case to the Supreme Court actually twice, essentially. On the second round, as I recall, just before the Supreme Court would have granted review of the case, what did they do, Dahlia?
It looked like the Supreme Court was going to, if they're about to hear the case, and the Bush administration would almost certainly lose the argument that basically a U.S. citizen could be held indefinitely without charge in this arbitrary detention. They quickly, suddenly transferred him from the military system that he'd been in, this enemy combatant status, to the criminal justice system. And this happened late 2005, November 2005, and that was when he was first charged in federal court. What was interesting about that charge was he wasn't charged with anything that they had been publicly accusing him of doing for years, but instead they just kind of tacked his case on to other defendants who had a case in progress. The exact charges were, you know, things that had nothing to do with what he'd been accused of doing, but things like conspiring to murder, conspiring, you know, to kidnap and maim people in other countries, and, of course, the famous providing material support.
Very weak charges in the end, even according to the judge, in a way, it's even though she gave him what I consider a very long sentence. Why don't you talk about that, what happened this week in terms of his sentence?
If anyone can imagine being in solitary confinement as an enemy combatant and just disappeared for 3.5 years and, you know, every day undergoing stress positions and torture and who knows what all happened, he wasn't, I don't think, mentally competent to stand trial. I mean, and that was one of the things that he lost. The bar for mental competency to stand trial is actually pretty low, isn't it?
Not low enough in this case.
Yeah.
I think that this person's mind disintegrated. That's the whole purpose, what the CIA did to him. That was the whole program that the CIA invented. We've had Al McCoy on our show, you'll remember, who talked about what prolonged isolation does to people. They lose their minds. They switched the charges. The guy lost his mind. They put him up for trial. Then what happened?
He wasn't allowed to submit evidence of the torture and ill treatment. They didn't talk about him being an enemy combatant. The prosecutors never introduced any evidence of him being involved in any specific terrorist plot or even any violent act, nothing specific. And the main evidence that he got 17 and a half years for was they had introduced some sort of application that he'd submitted, apparently, to join an al-Qaeda training camp in Afghanistan before 2001, in the year before in 2000. So the jury in the summer found him guilty and the two co-defendants on all counts. They found them guilty on everything. And they deliberated for a very short period of time. They just came back, said all three of them are guilty for everything. And this week was when he was finally sentenced. He's going to be spending a long time in prison for things that are very nonspecific under circumstances that are really dubious at best.
Yeah, really. I had two reactions to it. One was the government really did win when they called him the dirty bomber. You know, how many people heard that, and then how many people heard that they totally dropped those charges? So it was very effective in scaring the pants off of people, including jurors. You know, then they put him away, so there'll be no discussion about what happened.
Yeah, I'm just angry about the way this has all been covered in the media. They do call him, you know, the dirty bomber repeatedly. People probably don't know him as much by the dirty bomber as by his name. But also just in terms of the evidence, I don't think there's enough attacking of what the prosecutors put forth as evidence against him. You have the press talking about, I think it was Dan Egan in the Washington Post, I can't remember exactly who, talking again and again in the press about thousands of phone conversations used to convict him that the FBI had intercepted over the course of 8 years. And the reality is, out of those thousands of phone conversations, Padilla's voice was only on 7.
Yeah, and the other thing is, al-Qaeda was an organization supported by the United States, in fact, invented by the United States. They used it in Afghanistan. It was a part of the American ally for a while. So when this guy had those conversations with wanting to join al-Qaeda, at that time, this was before 9/11, it was a whole different thing.
Now this guy's going to be in jail for a long time, but, you know, Michael, he's got a suit against former Justice Department attorney.
Yeah, it was a fascinating suit and even surprised me. Interestingly, it's a suit called Padilla, the name of the person we've been discussing, against Yu, Y-O-O, and of course that's John Yu, the author of the torture memos, and not just the author, according to this suit, of the torture memos, but actually of the program that denied Jose Padilla due process as well as implemented some of the coercive torture techniques against him. And it was filed by the Lowenstein Human Rights Clinic at Yale Law School, interestingly enough, against John Yu out in California where you're sitting. It basically charges Yu with the constitutional violations of due process and the protections that Padilla should have been entitled to under our Constitution, not just as him giving legal advice, but as being part of a small cabal of people, such as Cheney, Addington, and the group, that essentially was there to deny fundamental rights to even American citizens like Jose Padilla. At least in the seemingly staid atmosphere of lawyers in Yale, it was a... So the lawsuit is actually quite important because, you know, you at this point, who is really one of the architects of the entire torture program, detention program, Guantanamo, is sitting out there in Berkeley, California as a professor at the law school, which is such a complete outrage.
Somebody, well, Dahlia, maybe we'll suggest this to you. Why can't somebody file charges with the California Bar Association to have him disbarred for his role?
You know what irritates me is that the law clinic at Yale has received a lot of criticism saying, "Oh, you're defending terrorists and attacking this law professor who provided a service to America." And they've come under a great deal of criticism.
Right. In fact, Dahlia, there was a half-page editorial in the Wall Street Journal calling Yale or the clinic or whatever a left-wing law bucket or something like that. I mean, some outrage and people threatening to hold back their donations. But in fact, it's an important lawsuit, and it's one that really tells it how it is. So I'm actually quite proud that a law school like Yale and its Lowenstein Clinic particularly was willing to go ahead with it. It
tells you something about the perversion of how we look at society nowadays and the rule of law, that somebody who said that torture is perfectly fine and gave legal advice saying that torture is fine is lauded as someone who needs to be protected from people who are concerned about those who are tortured and the destruction of rule of law in our country.
Thank you, Dahlia. The clinic that filed the lawsuit against John Yu on behalf of Jose Padilla is called the Lowenstein Law Clinic at Yale Law School, and it's actually where I taught, this is Michael Ratner speaking, where I taught from about 89 to 93, and we brought a lot of historic cases, but the main one that we got known for was the case to protect the HIV-positive Haitian refugees at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. I taught it with Harold Koh, currently the dean at Yale, and we actually had a major success in that case, freeing 400 people from an HIV camp at Guantanamo Bay that the United States government ran, and we got them all into the United States. So that clinic has a fighting historic human rights role, not just at Guantanamo, but other cases we've brought. And of course, now this case against you is important, and I'm proud to have been associated with that clinic in the past.
Michael, I saw in the news that the Canadian Foreign Ministry had listed the United States as a torturing country, and then all of a sudden things changed. What's the background?
Well, this is actually an utterly remarkable story. People should be completely shocked. I was shocked. Canadians should be shocked. Here's Canada, who we'd like think has at least a semblance of democracy. And as people listening to the show may remember, in the end, they did the right thing toward Mahar Arar, the Syrian, the Canadian citizen who was sent to Syria for torture. And they actually wound up with a public inquiry and settling with Mahar Arar for $11 million Canadian dollars because of their role with the United States in sending him to Syria for torture. That public inquiry, the Arar inquiry, which was done under subpoena, et cetera, came up with a series of recommendations that they said to the Canadian government, we want all our diplomats in Canada trained so that then when they visit Canadian prisoners in prisons around the world, they know that they should look for torture. And we mandate that as something Canadian diplomats ought to do, because Canadian diplomats actually went to see Arar and didn't raise the issue of torture. Now, that who knows whether training is going to help on that. But in any case, they set up this condition that Canadian diplomats ought to be trained. So what did Canada do? They started a program called the Torture Awareness Workshop, and they issued a set of materials to train all their diplomats in how to look for torture. And we'll actually put a link to this torture manual, training torture manual, on our website. It's a PowerPoint presentation, and in it, it gives a definition of torture, tells you what forms to fill out, talks about the Maher Arar case and what it requested the Canadian government to do. And then on one page of that report, it says there's certain countries where you should take special care when you have prisoners that you visit in those countries. And it's called Possible Torture Abuse Cases. And it lists such wonderful places as Afghanistan, China, Egypt, Guantanamo Bay, Iran, Israel, Mexico, Saudi Arabia, Syria, USA. So it has basically, what, 3, 5, 10 countries it lists. 2, United States and Guantanamo Bay, are related to us. What this is saying, when a diplomat goes to that country, you should be aware that the guy you're seeing may have been tortured.
So what happened?
Well, what happened is the ambassador made a public statement, the ambassador to the from the U.S. to Canada, or they picked up the phone and they said to Canada, what the heck are you doing here? Get us off this list. This is an outrage. And what does Canada dutifully do? They fold like an accordion folds.
Yeah.
Instantaneously. And they said, oh, and they basically genuflect to the United States. And they say, we'll take Guantanamo off. We'll take the United States off. And then Israel apparently made a complaint. And we'll take Israel off while we're at it. And so, and they're going to reissue the manual. Now, what they're going to do, I don't know, because the manual is filled with stuff about Maher Arar and his torture in the United States. I mean, the torture of rendering him to Syria for torture. So what are they going to do now? Take out the entire PowerPoint to take out all about Arar? I don't know. It's one of the most craven folds that I've ever looked at from somebody who stood up for Maher Arar. Of course, the government's changed in Canada, but it's still, I mean, people in Canada should just be screaming their heads off.
Yeah, yeah. But on the other hand, there was a moment of deep embarrassment for this government of ours.
You know, initially after Maher Arar, actually, when he was first taken from the United States to the torture chamber in Syria, Canada actually issued a warning to its citizens who are not native-born, you know, its naturalized citizens. It was a warning not to come to the United States because they might be subject to deportation, to torture. And of course, Canada withdrew that in a day early on. But what's shocking is, think about Maher Arar. He's sitting there, and his case was the key case for Canada finally begin to get on the right page on this issue. And then within one phone call of the United States, you know, as I said, they fold like an accordion. It's a lesson to all of us. You know, you have to just keep fighting. You can't trust governments. You just have to fight on.
Israel has ordered closure of all crossings into the Gaza Strip. All goods continue to be blocked, including humanitarian supplies from the UN. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees condemned the move, saying it will only worsen an already dire situation. Israel says it's trying to stop rocket attacks on the nearby Israeli town of Sderot. We get an update on the crisis in Gaza with Muna Kubti. Muna is a Palestinian-American and works with the Free Palestine Alliance and the Answer Coalition in Los Angeles. Muna, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, thank you for having me.
The world, I think, and at least the progressive world, is shocked at what has been happening with the Israeli cutoff of fuel and other supplies in the Gaza Strip. Can you give us an update on what's happening specifically there?
Yes. Right now what we're seeing is one of those rare opportunities for the world to get a glimpse into the lives of what it's like to be a Palestinian in Gaza. As we speak, it continues to be a siege on the 1.5 million inhabitants of Gaza who have been strictly confined to their small living space with a complete closure by Israel of all of its borders and Egypt, with no supplies being able to reach into Gaza, most notably since the end of last week in January 20th, Israel has cut off all shipments of fuel into Gaza, which has caused a devastating impact on life inside. The cutoff of fuel supplies means that the only power plant in Gaza has been unable to function adequately. Generators are for hospitals, for individual homes, are unable to be fueled. The sewage system has been inoperable, causing sewage to spill into the streets. And just from these examples, you can see that the lives of hundreds of thousands of Gazans has been completely devastating in a form of collective punishment on the people of Gaza.
And really, this rises to the level of genocide in a way.
Absolutely. I mean, when you impose such harsh conditions on a whole group of people, which this is intended on all of its 1.5 million inhabitants, this is a form of slow genocide. And if you were to listen strictly to the words of the U.S. and Israel, you would think that this has only been going on for 1 week. But in fact, a siege of Gaza has been taking place for quite some time, since 2006. This has all been a result of the slow strangulation of Gaza and the Palestinians to conform to the will of the U.S. and Israel and force them into a so-called peace plan that they've been trying to impose for many years.
Of course, Israel, you know, I was reading something and says they were accused of it being a form of collective punishment, which is, of course, illegal. And Israel then comes back and says, well, no, it's not collective punishment. We just want to stop the rocket attacks on Israel. Well, that's actually the definition of collective punishment.
Absolutely.
Somebody may or may not be doing a rocket attack, and then they decide to punish 1.5 million people as a way of trying to stop a rocket attack. It's illegal.
It is illegal. Mm-hmm. It goes against many international laws. And we can't look at what's happening in Gaza now in a matter of a week span and any rocket attacks that have taken place along the border in just the past week. We have to look at this as a slow, as Heidi was saying, the slow denigration of life of Palestinians that's been taking place for many years. You have to look at who lives in Gaza. The people that live in Gaza have been displaced from their homes for generations. You have Palestinian refugees living in Gaza. Over the many generations, they've learned that because of the U.S. intentions in the Middle East and because of Israel's policies, their lives have become what they are finally today.
Muna, just because we're always interested in learning more about the background of our guests, where are you from and what has your involvement been in this issue?
Well, I am Palestinian. My family is among the Palestinians who now make up about 20% of the population inside of Israel or the historic 1948 borders of Palestine. My family still lives there, despite the attempts to separate Palestinians between those who live inside of Israel and those who live outside of Israel. We are very much still in touch with what's happening to our brothers and sisters in Gaza. The situation in Gaza is very desperate, and it's being felt in the hearts and minds of Palestinians no matter where they live. My family is very much in tune with what's going on. Oftentimes, you know, here in the United States, we have sources of alternative media that show us photos, images of the conditions, and it's really just been heart-wrenching for all of those who are having to watch this happen.
You know, I can imagine when I was in Israel as part of a National Lawyers Guild delegation years ago before the first Intifada, I was able to tour some of the refugee camps. But the situation is Gaza. I think that's one of the most densely populated places on the planet. And for them not to have not only fuel and electricity, but not have adequate food supplies, I read somewhere that there's actual malnutrition and brain damage amongst the children because they're not getting sufficient nourishment.
Gaza, when you really look at it, it's only about 25 miles long and no more than about 6 miles wide. It's a very small area. And with 1.5 million people living there, it's the most densely populated area in the world. Right now, with the borders being completely controlled by Israel and a small portion by Egypt, the airspace is controlled by Gaza, you know, the water access is controlled by Israel. It's virtually the largest prison in the world, and that's not an exaggeration. The people in Gaza are virtually dependent completely on the opening and closing of these border crossings. And the fact that these borders have been so tightly controlled over the past couple of years especially has meant that life in Gaza is just any person in the world would be shocked and find it unacceptable if they knew what it was like for a typical Palestinian in Gaza right now.
We're speaking with Muna Kubti, a Palestinian living in Los Angeles, has been active with the Answer Coalition in defense of the Palestinians. What do you say to those apologists for the United States and Israel who say, well, the Israelis are just defending themselves from these rocket attacks? Can you give us some background to that, please?
Well, it's long been the strategy from the U.S. and Israel to depict the conflict between Palestinians and Israelis as some sort of equal playing field, that the Palestinians have equal power, they have equal access to military capabilities. All of these things are totally false. What has been happening over many decades is a slow wearing down of the Palestinian people in order for them to, one, leave their land, which has always been the intention since 1948, for Palestinians to find it so unbearable to live in Gaza and the West Bank and other parts that they'll want to just kind of give up their identity and move to other parts in the Middle East or wherever. I don't think it really mattered to Israel. But also, it's been 60 years, and the Palestinians haven't left despite these conditions. This is their home. And so they are trying to find alternatives with these proposed peace plans from the United States and from Israel. You know, while Bush was in Israel with all of this happening, he said not a word about what was going on in Gaza. The sheer might of Israel, with its military capabilities, receiving so much funds from the United States, and a basic green light from the United States to do what it wants, Israel has really unleashed all its force against the Palestinian people. And so to compare that with, you know, these rocket attacks that are happening over the borders, is not really understanding what's happening there right now.
Muna, the National Lawyers Guild issued a statement late last week about the situation. In it, we called for members to send letters of protest demanding a lifting of the siege to Professor Daniel Friedman, Minister of Justice in Jerusalem. And we also supported the worldwide demonstrations that occurred several days ago in cities around the country. What can people do? I know you're a member of the Free Palestine Alliance.
Yes. There are several organizations that were putting on these demonstrations this past week, and particularly this past weekend. And it's important to know that these are taking place all over the country and also all over the world because of the sheer outrage of what's taking place in Gaza right now. This is not the end. I mean, as we've said, this is not something that's just been going on for a week. Even though Israel allowed in some very small token humanitarian aid into Gaza last week, the siege continues, and they have no intention whatsoever of lifting it. The Prime Minister of Israel even said firmly that it will not allow a humanitarian crisis in Gaza, as if that hasn't already happened, but it's not going to provide, quote, luxury products and allow them to live comfortable lives, which is such a sheer slap in the face for Palestinians who live nothing close to a comfortable life. So we have to keep in mind that, keep the letters coming, keep the protests going. Let us not forget what is happening right now there, because it's the responsibility of all of those of us who believe in justice and peace to continue the struggle to make the lives of people in Gaza better, because they're doing what they can.
I know, you know, I don't want to take responsibility off Israel, which is really obviously where it belongs. And I know Egypt gets a couple billion dollars a year from the United States to make sure that they do pretty much what's in the U.S.'s interests here, as well as Israel's. But there's this gate on the other side of Gaza that goes into Egypt. That's called the Rafah Gate.
Yes.
And there was actually a picture in the New York Times of that gate closing or opening. And what's the relationship of Egypt to what's happening in Gaza and to the imprisonment? And what's their role here? And what are they doing?
Well, the situation with Egypt is that, of course, it has a very large population, and that population is vastly in support of and sympathizes with what's happening with the Palestinians. They see it as a common struggle. However, the government of Egypt is a very different thing. The government of Egypt receives $1 billion of aid from the United States, making it the second largest recipient of foreign aid from the U.S. after Israel. And this has all been since one of these so-called peace plans, you know, the Camp David Accords that took place decades ago.
It was done to close the agreement, actually. That was the way they got Egypt to the table, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's been the string that the U.S. pulls ever since. and that is that Egypt must control its population and control this border crossing between Gaza and Egypt. And that's what they attempted to do. They attempted to completely seal off the Rafah border crossing until protesters led by a women's protest literally broke through that border crossing and a large portion of it and went into Egypt to get food and supplies. I mean, we're talking about the basic necessities of life. In response to that, Egypt really can't do much because, as I said, you know, the people of Egypt overwhelmingly support the Palestinians. To really just lash out so harshly would be not in the interest of the Egyptian government. The demonstrations we saw this past week in the United States are a clear sign that the people in the U.S. are becoming more aware of what's happening to the people of Palestine, that we will not tolerate, no matter who we are or where we come from, the inhumane treatment that is coming from Israel, and the green light that's been given by this government, the United States, to continue this absolutely horrendous humanitarian crisis. I look forward to hearing from those who believe in peace and justice and seeing all of you out in the streets to end this attack on the Palestinian people.
We'll see you in the streets, Mona.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mona Khoubtree, for the excellent interview.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take care.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. Today we're going to bring you an absolutely critical interview with Peter Linebaugh, the author of a new book called Magna Carta Manifesto. What's extraordinary about this book is how it changes how we think about the Magna Carta. When you mention Magna Carta, we at the Center for Constitutional Rights, the Guild, all of us, think about political freedoms, the right to be free from torture, the right to be free from arbitrary detention, the Guantanamo detainees, all those basic rights that King John was forced to give up at Runnymede in the year 1215 when the nobles really confronted him, but it also meant a lot of rights for the people. One of the things Peter's new book does is it puts that struggle, and it was a struggle, it didn't just happen, in an historical context, but it brings up another charter that was like a companion to the Magna Carta called the Charter of the Forest. And what the Charter of the Forest did was talk about fundamental economic rights and how that people not only had the right not to be put in jail just by the king's word, but they also had a right to essentially a baseline of being able to live and exist, which meant they had a right to the commons, the right to the forest, the right to put their pig in the forest, the right to graze their animals, and that a lot of property was seen as the commons belonging to the public. And what has happened, obviously, since 1215 has not only been, particularly in the current period, the suppression of political rights, but obviously the complete removal from our history or of this tradition of struggle over fundamental economic rights. And what Peter Linebaugh's book, The Magna Carta Manifesto, does and why it's so critical to today is it brings back the issue and the importance of fundamental economic rights, rights that many of us think are necessary for anyone to be able to exercise other kinds of political rights from the First Amendment on. Today, we're really pleased to have really a pioneering author, Peter Linebaugh, who will talk to us about his new book, Magna Carta Manifesto.
Peter, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
I'm really pleased to have you here. You know, Peter, I've followed your work for a long time. I've read some of your earlier books, London Hanged and some others, which we'll talk about. But the book you're coming out with this week, with the Magna Carta Manifesto, is to me really in some ways one of the most important books you've come out with. And I know I've followed, you know, from my point of view, of course, the Magna Carta, from the work I do on Guantanamo, is the fundamental charter of human liberty in the sense of what we call civil rights or the right not to be arrested without a trial, etc. But there's another part of the Magna Carta that I think this book talks about. What are you doing with the Magna Carta, and what does it really represent to you as we look at our world today?
My work on the Magna Carta began with the crisis, the constitutional crisis of the preemptive endless war on terror after 2001. The subtitle of my book is called Liberties and Commons for All. And the liberties part, we're all very well aware of how they've been taken away, whether it's at Guantanamo or Afghanistan or people in New Orleans or Baghdad. The commons part, commons for all, we're less accustomed to seeing in Magna Carta. And yet Magna Carta is full of safeguards against privatizers, against those who would take common property or the results of common neighborhood human labor and privatize it for their own profit. And this is an essential part of Magna Carta, and it's an essential part of our world today, as from Sumatra to Chiapas, from Asia, South America, to the native people of our own country.
Well, I mean, I guess the most graphic example, and I guess there's many that you're going to give, but in the 1500s, it was about common rights to the forest or to the deer or whatever. And today it might be about common rights to the oil wealth of a country or other kinds of common rights. And what's interesting to me, of course, is that when we learn about the Magna Carta in school, is we never really talk about what are property rights or really the rights of the public or the commons to share in the wealth of the country. It's always about civil and political rights, the right to free speech, et cetera, which, while important, are not the only rights we're talking about. And without sort of a fundamental base in the economic structure, they're not that meaningful.
Right. This is what I found when I began studying Magna Carta. It was on the 11th of September, 1217, after the 1215 document was lost and civil war had resumed. It was found again on that date and produced with a smaller charter called the Charter of the Forest. And it did exactly what you just described. It was forms of protection of subsistence rights for people to the woodlands. And in that epoch of history, more so than our own, the woods was the form that hydrocarbon energy took. And so there's an exact parallel, not just a chemical parallel, but a historical and social parallel between the protection of the woodlands for all back then and the protection and our own oil economy.
You know, what's interesting about that division between what we call the Magna Carta and the Charter of the Forest, which in some way you could broadly, I'm not sure I'm right, but divides civil and political rights from economic and maybe social rights. It's the same division that you see in United Nations documents and treaties today. We have a treaty on political and civil rights, and we have another treaty on economic and social rights. And of course, in this country, all of our human rights organizations, or almost all of them, are familiar with enforcing political and civil rights, but getting economic and social rights enforced is essentially a zero. I mean, it's not that we just don't want to do it. It's just that it's nothing you can do with it in the courts. They just don't want to go there. So one of the reasons I think your work is so critical is it's really reviving where the origins of those rights are.
Right. And I went to look at that division in the late 1940s. What I learned there was that it was the great American, African-American W.E.B. Du Bois who attacked that separation of rights of the stomach, so to speak, from rights of speech, or from civil and political rights on the one hand, from economic rights on the other. Du Bois argued with Eleanor Roosevelt, and he argued at Bretton Woods on behalf of the millions of people of the Third World, the people of color who had been excluded from this post-war deal.
I learned from the great historian Harvey Goldberg, who was my professor at Wisconsin, that the ideology of private property really crashed asunder these rights we're talking about, and that with John Locke and the bourgeois revolutions in the 17th and 18th century, the idea that private property was just a social construct and could be set aside for the common good was wrecked. And after that, you had the kind of avarice, you know, just uncontrolled capitalism that we have today. And he took it all the way back to the 17th and 18th century.
Right. And I take it back even earlier than that. I go to Shakespeare's time, and I go before that as well, back to the 13th century when Magna Carta was promulgated. And I think it's important for us in America. Our education emphasizes John Locke. And what we forget is that John Locke was answering a very powerful thinker, Jared Winstanley. And it was Winstanley who said that the earth belonged to no one, that it was a common treasury for all. Winstanley was part of the levelers of the English Civil War. And it was these people who John Locke was really frightened of. And so he developed his notions of private property in contrast to them.
I know the book is going to take us back through the history of this. Can you just tell us something about the focus of the book? It's going to go back through the history, but is it also going to go forward till today? And what lessons in terms of thinking about our political work today will it give us?
I've been thinking about this, and the lessons for us today, I think, depends on a kind of creativity and widespread discussion that we haven't had yet. And that's a discussion that must occur in the grassroots. I think as you look through history, you know that the ruling class is able to retain its avaricious powers only to the extent that it keeps us apart, that it keeps the others apart. And we're familiar with gender and racial divisions, but also they have to throw us together in some circumstances, you know, whether it's the emergency of flood or earthquake, or whether it's their own deeds that have turned our own country into basically a prison, a carceral continent we've become. And then people get together and we begin talking. We learn that so much in our history has been stolen from us, whether it's our land or whether it's our cities or whether it's our wealth. And we have a commoning past ourselves that goes to Frederick Douglass or to Jane Addams or John L. Lewis. And we must recover that knowledge of our own commoning in contrast to the dominant narrative of American history, which is one of the triumph of capitalism, the triumph of private property, the triumph of consumer society, and a constitutional discussion that sees the Constitution not just as a matter of government, but a matter of social and economic order or of security for all is going to require us to do some deep thinking. It's in the belief of the necessity of that I wrote this book about the Magna Carta and why I call it a manifesto, because it manifests or brings to our attention some things that we used to think were racial or conservative, like the English Magna Carta. But when you look at them, there is a history of English-speaking workers around the world that haven't bowed down, haven't bent their backs to the burden and the weight of the oppressors. It's in this belief that we need to have a deeper constitutional discussion than just a matter of government, but a matter of what constitutes our society.
For those who've just tuned in to Law and Disorder, we're speaking with Peter Linebaugh about his wonderful new book, Magna Carta Manifesto, subtitled Liberties and Commons for All. And Peter, I wanted to ask you to address yourself to the three main things that I remember from civics class that came out of that document from the year 1215. Habeas corpus, of course, and trial by jury, and the right not to be tortured. Can you tell us about how that came up in that document and where things stand today in your view?
Sure. Well, it comes up in Chapter 39. Chapter 39 of Magna Carta used to be part of a Latin that school children had to learn, And it's engraved in many of the older courthouses of the United States, Chapter 39, that you can't be deprived or you can't be imprisoned, you can't be destroyed without judgment by your peers and due process of law. And where it stands today, I think you have been world exemplars in the struggle to revive them, to keep them alive against the destruction of habeas corpus, against the widespread use of torture, against the unaccounted, unchecked imprisonments. And really, my hat's off to the people who are litigating and defending those in Guantanamo Bay.
You know, Peter, I want to address that for a second because I feel, you know, really strongly, obviously, about the torture issues in Guantanamo. And yet at the same time, I realize that what's really lacking in this country is any awareness of what you're trying to say in this book and what economic rights mean and what it means to have a good education and good health care and to share the commons. And I do think even in our work here at, you know, in New York or in civil liberties groups around the country, that's really a perspective that's lacking. And when you see that 1 billion people in the world basically have some money and 5 billion don't, you just think about how your work is crucial and the perspective that it has to bring, really, to the work of people in the United States.
Yeah, we have. When I say we need to learn our history, I mean we, you know, we just celebrated Martin Luther King's birthday last week. And this is a man who spoke against materialism, who spoke against imperialism, and who spoke against racism as the three sources of oppression.
What he called the triplets.
Exactly, exactly, the three-headed triplet.
Right.
That's right. And he sought a battering ram that could bring these down. And Frederick Douglass had said the Magna Carta was such a battering ram. And if I can just quote another part of Magna Carta that I think goes directly to your question, and that is from its Chapter 7, which says, "She shall have in the meantime her reasonable estovers in the common." And this puts forth, you know, a notion of material life that's not just devil take the hindmost. It's not that competitive society which leads to the capitalist classes that we're so familiar with, where the security of a tiny number of people is purchased at the insecurity of millions of people all around our planet. And it's that job that Magna Carta calls on us, or Magna Carta is there to help us do, you know, if we want to do that.
Now, you mentioned the word estover. I remember reading a draft of your book and wondering about what does that word mean. So can you just go through that quote again and just say something about estover?
Yeah. Estover is a medieval term. Edward Cook explained its meaning. He was a jurist who was the teacher, so to speak, of Blackstone and the American founding fathers. Estovers, he explained, was the right to go to the woodlands to collect wood for nurturance. It would depend on the locale, how much wood you could take out, for precisely what purpose it would be used for food, for tools, for fuel, for cooking. These would be some of the uses. So estovers referred to that right among the commoners. And the commoners would be the poor people of any particular locale.
And Peter, do you go into the driving off the land, the privatization of the commons, and the formation of the working class where they were forced into the cities and forced into these 16-hour-a-day jobs and really not part of nature anymore, not part of any kind of collective society, but really just like wage slaves? How does that coincide with the loss of these rights under Magna Carta?
Yeah, that's a deep question, because a deal was made, I think, in the 1830s and 1840s among the English working class. Remember, that's a time of the anti-slavery movement in the Americas. But in the English working class said, if you're going to drive us into the factories, you must provide us with the wherewithal that you've just stolen from us. In other words, we've lost our commons. We've lost the ability to put a pig in the forest or to graze a sheep or to collect wood. And in return, we insist upon having economic rights. We insist upon. So money was regarded or became part of the working class demand for subsistence. And I think it remained that way, you know, right through the American New Deal, right through the welfare program in Great Britain during World War II, you know, with the cradle to the grave welfare policy. But in our own era, welfare, we've lost both. We've lost both our commons, and we've lost the money that we were supposed to have in return for that loss. Now, I think more than ever, we have to return to perhaps the fundamental part of Magna Carta, which Tom Paine pointed out in Common Sense, which is the right of resistance. We have to begin our constitutional discussion of reconstituting our society while resisting the present expropriators, if I can use the term of those who take away common rights, who privatize for their personal gain the wealth that used to belong to the public or belong to our class or belongs to the commoners.
That's where your discussion really of oil is so interesting to me, because, you know, obviously most of the oil countries in the world, because once you can control oil, you just don't need to develop anything else in the country, and you don't, and it can be privatized, etc., is obviously a crucial issue. And in that context, I look at Iraq and Venezuela, and when the U.S. went into Iraq, obviously the new oil deal is essentially going to be to privatize oil again in Iraq and take it away even from the state, essentially, more or less. Whereas in Venezuela, you have a situation where there's actually oil wealth that is looked at as part of the patrimony of the people, at least broadly. I don't know if that's what you think, but that's at least my sort of broad take on it.
Yes, I think so, too. And I would add to that Nigeria or, you know, other parts of the oil-producing regions of the world.
Nigeria in what sense?
Where there, too, the big oil companies, formerly the Seven Sisters, have divided up the offshore waters for drilling rights, and many commoners. You remember Ken Sarawiwa, for example.
The center represents him and his family. He was actually murdered.
Uh-huh. Right. They were defending commoners in the mangrove commons along the delta against the pollution, against the prostitution, against the depredations of the big oil companies.
When you look at Venezuela today, I mean, you can think that one of the major reasons for the attacks on Venezuela is really the fact that they're treating oil quite differently than the United States wants it treated in Iraq or in places like Nigeria. So he's just under a major attack in the way of almost socializing oil.
Mm-hmm. And it shows that there can be transcontinental oil swaps, as Chavez has proposed and I think has done partly, even in the U.S.,
Now, Peter, I know you're coming to New York with your book, a couple of book parties. Is there one that the public can go to?
Oh, at Blue Stockings next Saturday, the 2nd of February at 7 o'clock, a wonderful bookstore on the Lower East Side. That's one place. And then I'm lecturing at New York University at a public lecture at 2:30 in the afternoon on the 31st of January, on Thursday. And certainly you and your listeners are welcome to these, and we can continue the discussion.
Peter, I'm going to have to miss your lecture, but I have one other question I wanted to get your thoughts on. With respect to the rights of habeas corpus and trial by jury and to be free of torture that Magna Carta sought to secure for the population, we've chronicled in our program from the very beginning with the Patriot Act up until the Military Commission Act that these rights have been taken away in the wake of 9/11. And we've made the point that this is just not an abstraction, because without these rights, you can't struggle for social progress. And we're dismayed, I think, to realize that I don't think it's the common perceptions in the population of the United States just what they've lost and just what they could lose in the future. And that's why I think your book is so valuable as a document for people to take a long view of history and see what they used to have and what they don't have now.
Well, thank you very much. That's certainly its purpose, that a long view is needed right now. And we have to be up and doing, as William Lloyd Garrison used to say. That is, get off our tushes and start teaching, start agitating, start arguing. And I would like to see, you know, even Magna Carta clubs in every law school. I would like to see a widespread discussion. throughout the U.S. And, of course, this discussion is happening elsewhere in the world. You mentioned Venezuela, but we could add Oaxaca in Mexico or Bolivia, of course, or Brazil or Argentina. People are beginning to talk about the commons again and are beginning to argue back against the privatizers and profiteers. And this is going to come back to us, and so we need to begin this discussion.
Listeners, we've been speaking with really one of the great professors in the country, Peter Linebaugh, who has written Magna Carta Manifesto, Liberties and Commons for All. The book is just out. For those in New York, they can go to the Blue Stockings bookstore and hear Peter speak, or go to NYU. We'll put up that information on our website, lawanddisorder.org. But Peter Linebaugh, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. And really, it's terrific pioneering work, and I really appreciate it.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
It's all right, I think it's for your mama. One beat for the drama. Hey, it's a karma, I say. When things go your way, you say, it's all right, it's all right. It's all right. Hey! It's all right. I know it's all right.